From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. Our topic, solutions to inequality in America. Our guest, Heather McGee, author of the new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. She's also chair of the Board of Color of Change, the country's largest online racial justice organization, and volunteers for numerous other boards in the fields of philanthropy and social justice. Heather McGee is a former president and currently trustee emeritus of the nonpartisan think tank Demos, which aims to promote research and action toward a just, inclusive, and multiracial democracy. In her book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, Heather accentuates the impact and legacy of slavery and the residual and pervasive racism against African Americans, which permeates almost every aspect of our country, from housing to education to health care. She says that despite being the richest nation on earth, America suffers from a scarcity mindset, meaning that white America would rather go without than invite black America in. She calls this phenomenon a zero-sum mentality. However, she argues that while black Americans are the main victims of racism, little will change until white people realize what racism has cost them as well. When minorities suffer, so do the majority of Americans. She says that the material legacy of slavery can be felt to this day in the form of depressed wages, scarce access to health care, and the hollowing out of America's working class. She says that these are consequences of the Southern economy with its deep legacy of exploitative labor and divide-and-conquer tactics. And yet Heather McGee's book is optimistic. She coins the phrase solidarity dividend, which she defines as gains that accrue when people come together across race to work for the common good. We will talk with Heather McGee about both the causes and solutions to inequality in America. And Heather McGee joins us via Microsoft Teams. Heather, welcome to the program.
I'm so glad to be with you.
And I'm also delighted to welcome my colleague, Chris Simpkins.
Pleasure to be with you, Carol.
So Heather McGee, let me first ask you, what prompted you to write this book in the first place, and how did you go about it?
Well, I had spent nearly 20 years working in the think tank world, trying to bring economic research to policymakers to convince them to make better economic policy decisions at a time of rising economic insecurity and inequality in the United States, at a time when the richest 1% of our population owns more wealth than the entire middle class, and yet 40% of adult workers before the pandemic were paid too little to meet their basic needs. Obviously, the economy wasn't delivering for so many of the people that were contributing to it, and yet we kept failing to raise the minimum wage, to provide universal health care, update our infrastructure, which used to be the envy of the world and is now fallen into disrepair, and then adapt our human infrastructure, the kinds of social benefits that many other advanced economies take for granted, such as universal paid family leave and childcare and pre-K. It seemed like we were simply shortchanging ourselves, like we couldn't find a way to give Americans the nice things that it seems like every human being who contributes to the nation's prosperity should be able to benefit from. And so after frustration, to be honest, I left my job as the president of a think tank and hit the road. I went across the country multiple times, from Maine to Mississippi to California and back again, talking to hundreds of Americans about their America, what they saw, how they understood not just questions of dollars and cents, but questions of status and belonging, of worth and value, questions that in the United States always seem to turn on race.
As I said in the introduction, you conclude that even though African Americans are the main victims of racism, your book is predicated on the idea that little will change until white people realize that racism costs them as well. Talk about what you mean by that.
Well, you see it in so many ways. First, from the very macro, in the past year, there have been three different studies that have counted in the trillions with a T, the economic costs to the U.S. economy of racial economic inequality. Citigroup last summer calculated that if we had closed the racial economic divide between black and white families 20 years ago, our economy would be $16 trillion larger. But of course, it makes sense, right? It's the idea that if you keep sidelining so many of your players, they won't be able to score points for your team. But that's just it, Carol. What I discovered at the beginning of my journey is that too many Americans, and disproportionately white Americans, less so Americans of color, see that we're not all on the same team. They believe that there's an us and a them within the American people. And so there's this zero-sum mentality, the idea that there are only so many points you can score, and so one more point for the opposite team means one less for you. The idea that progress for people of color has to come at white folks' expense. And so what that has meant in practice has been that white Americans have been ambivalent at best and resistant at worst to the kinds of public investments and public benefits and rule changes that would make it easier for everyone to thrive out of a fear that it would help the people they see as being on the opposing team. And that's costing us all.
And this zero-sum mentality that you describe has always puzzled me because, as you say, and as we all know, this is pretty much the richest country on earth.
That's right.
We're a big pie, and it's hard to see that somebody's success means, you know, somebody else's failure.
Yeah.
But we can get into that a little later. Let me turn to my colleague, Chris, for a question.
Thank you, Carol. I think Heather makes a good point, and I'd just like to highlight a Kellogg Foundation study that showed if we address inequities in America that are systematic, whether it's education, housing, criminal justice, unemployment, the GDP, the gross domestic product, the output of all goods and products in America, grows by some $8 trillion. So I think that's a good point to make, Heather. My question for you from the book, you talk about the elite have used race as a mechanism to maintain control, pitting poor whites against people of color. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can talk about it from a story from people that I met on my journey. I went to Mississippi where, in the wake of a failed union organizing drive at a car manufacturer, that, by the way, all of their plants outside of the United States are unionized, but they've resisted unionization in the U.S. and in the American South. And I sat and talked to workers about why a bare majority, but a majority nonetheless, had voted against joining a union that promised them better wages and benefits and a voice on the job. And it became clear from my conversations with black, white, for the union, against the union workers, that race was really the dividing line. A white worker named Joey told me, "The white workers down here get this southern mentality," he said. "If the blacks are for it, I'm against it." Another worker named Chip, who was white, said, "We have this crab in a barrel mentality, always, you know, clawing at each other to get on top." And it's that sense of a ladder of human hierarchy, which in the United States has always been so steep, of course, because the first bottom of that ladder was the picture of human rightslessness, right? Was slavery, was labor that was paid exactly zero, labor that was stolen from a people whom were stolen. And so when you have the bottom and the floor being so low, there is this desire to cling desperately to your level of status. And yet, of course, what we know is that if white workers had been willing to join with black workers in a union, they would have been able to have more material comforts. And yet the major tension in our society that has really stymied class solidarity in the United States is the racial division and the use by people who profit from that division, who profit from a divided working class, of racial stereotypes, racial demonization, this zero-sum rhetoric that we hear from politicians in the United States all the time.
Heather McGee, as your book outlines, the history of slavery, the legacy is just profound and pervasive in this country. And we are suffering today from that in the form of racism. And as you describe, and I find very interesting, the white majority in this country you know, has had many advantages over the years. There's something that we call the Homestead Act in housing, where mostly whites were able to buy homes in suburbs. Those same suburbs were what we call redlined. They were designed such that they would keep out blacks, and blacks were not benefiting from these same subsidies by banks and so forth. So we have this segregation also in our education system, in our public education system, so that most of the public schools, many public schools, let me say it that way, are inferior to some of the private schools. The private schools are frequented primarily by whites. Discuss this structural racism and how, you know, we can start to claw our way out of this.
You know, the central metaphor in my book also applies to public schools. It's the story of what happened to public pools in America. In the 1930s and 40s, the country went on a building boom of public amenities, public parks, libraries, schools, and pools. And it was really part of an overarching ethos in the New Deal era of the 30s and 40s, the understanding that government had a role in providing a higher and higher standard of living for the American people. Things like the massive subsidization of home ownership for tens of millions of mainly white ethnic immigrants who would have never dreamed that they could own a home, to the labor protections of the New Deal, through to the GI Bill in the mid-1940s, which was transformational in terms of college education and home ownership for GIs and veterans in the United States from World War II. And yet, all of that that I just described, either explicitly, as in the case of the home ownership subsidies that the federal government barred black neighborhoods and black people from being a part of, through to the GI Bill, which was race neutral on its face, and yet was filtered through segregated housing and education sectors. Most of that big public investment to create the great American middle class was segregated and for whites only. And so too, Carol and Chris, were the public swimming pools in so many parts of the country, not just in the American South. And so when in the late 1950s and early 60s, black families began to successfully advocate and sue and say, hey, those are our tax dollars funding those grand resort-style public swimming pools that could hold 1,000 swimmers at a time. We want our kids to swim too. Communities faced a choice. And I visited Montgomery, Alabama, but this also happened in Warren, Ohio, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Washington State, all over the country, where public pools that were segregated, instead of integrating them during the civil rights movement, the cities opted to drain their public pools instead. They literally drained out the water, backed truckloads of dirt in, and seeded it over with grass. They eliminated what had been a public good enjoyed by white families in order to keep it from being enjoyed by black families too. That meant that upper middle class white families were able to build backyard pools, which we began to see as a feature of suburban neighborhoods, and membership-only private swim clubs cropped up all across the country. But that meant that what was once a public good became a private amenity. And that, for me, the story of the drained public pools is a metaphor for what's happened to our entire economy since the era when the United States deliberately and thoughtfully created broadly shared economic prosperity, to the era over the last 50 years, really ramping up in the 1970s when we began to see changes in our tax laws, in our trade and labor laws, in our housing and financial protection laws that made it harder for working families to be secure as the country became more diverse and as the white population politically really turned their backs on the formula that had created their own middle class security, because they then had to share the benefits of that formula with people they had been taught to disdain and distrust.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Heather McGee, author of The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. She joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Bar Inusa Mohammed from Gombe, Nigeria. Well, we love our faithful Nigerians, but we also want to hear from other parts of the continent and, of course, the world. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Heather McGee. I have a quick comment before I turn to my colleague, Chris. When I was growing up, my father was a traveling salesman. He was a wholesaler. He used to sell to retailers, shoemakers, shoe repair shops, leather findings and rubber footwear and things like that. And he had an Italian shoemaker who said to him once, he said, you know, with respect to African Americans, you know, I'm an immigrant and, you know, I worked hard and they, meaning African Americans, you know, those people should pick themselves up by their bootstraps. To which my father said, sir, did your ancestors come over in chains? And I say that because, and I admire my dad for confronting him, because as you say, racism is so pervasive, this myth that African Americans are sort of responsible for poverty or whatever conditions they find themselves in is simply a myth and it needs to be dispelled. I think that's very important. I don't know how much further we have come since those days, but I think unfortunately this myth is still with us.
It is, Carol, and I appreciate you sharing that memory. One of the things that I aim to do in this book is obviously the subtitle, the whole thesis is that racism has a cost for everyone, and yet I never shy away from really sharing that racism's main impact is on people of color, obviously, people who are hurt first and worst. And I take pains in the book to really bust some of those myths about why there are currently economic disparities. I mean, first of all, obviously the majority of Black families are not in poverty, and yet there are economic disparities. And those are really attributable to those kinds of policies that created middle-class security, that excluded Black families, and then the intergenerational compounding of advantage that comes from your grandparents owning a home. And you really see this in the racial wealth divide, wealth being not your paycheck, but what you have in the bank, your savings, your investments, your home ownership and home equity, your pension. Those are the things that really are transformational to financial freedom, and that's where history shows up in families' wallets. It's where we are today paying compounding interest on decisions, racist decisions made long before we were born. Today, a Black family headed by a college graduate has less average wealth than a white family headed by a high school dropout. Now, that should just go to show that it's not about Black people not pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, but rather it's about the impact of these racist decisions. And yet, the racial wealth divide itself that I just gave an example of cost the overall economy over $1 trillion a year, according to McKinsey. We would all do better if we all did better.
Heather, you talked about the wealth gap, but I'm also interested because in the educational gap we have in this country, I often hear from people who are from other countries who come to America asking me, why are African Americans' education levels not the same as whites? Could you talk about how the government has been involved in this and in the creation of a public and private university system as kind of an example of some of the reasons why we have this educational gap among people of color and whites?
First of all, the United States has a system where our primary, elementary, and secondary schools, the public schools, are funded in large part based on local taxes that come from local property values. Now, if you remember what I described about the way the federal government drew maps of the country for most of the 20th century and drew red lines around Black neighborhoods and told banks, do not lend, that meant that Black people were barred from owning property for much of the 20th century. So our home ownership rates are about 20 percentage points lower than white home ownership rates. And so that means that our communities have lower property taxes to fund our schools. Now, a fairer society might say every child, no matter their zip code, should get the same resources to be able to invest in their future. And yet we link our children's futures to these racist past policies. And so that's one of the reasons why you have these educational disparities. But I want to be clear that Black young people have virtually narrowed the college attainment gap. We are going to college in more and more numbers, and yet we're going into a system that today, as really an outlier in the advanced economy world and an outlier from what we used to do, people going to public colleges have to pay the majority of the costs themselves through loans from the government that have interest rates that mean that the average borrower is repaying 33% more than they borrowed in the first instance. Now, I talk in the Some of Us about how that itself is a cost of systemic racism. We used to have our government pick up the tab for people to go to college, and that was because it was a good public investment. And we've switched, as our country has become more diverse, to a debt for diploma system, which disproportionately impacts Black students, but also affects the majority of white students as well.
Heather, I wanted to pick up on one of your arguments in the book where you say that it's important that we anticipate shifts in opinions and views before we necessarily make policy. What about the role of leadership in government? Just as government helped so many white Americans own homes and, you know, have better educational possibilities, what about today? Do you see a light, perhaps with the Biden administration, if the Biden administration is successful in passing some landmark legislation, maybe this infrastructure bill? To what extent might that push from the top, you know, help along with this shift in opinion that you're trying to generate?
Well, I spent my 20 years of a career trying to advance public policy solutions, many of which are on the Biden agenda. So I think this is an historic opportunity to address inequality. And the Biden-Harris administration has put racial equity at the center. They are not taking for granted the economic divides that we have in the country. And they have designed policies to help close those gaps so that we can all flourish and our economy can be stronger for everyone. The American Rescue Plan, which passed, is in my mind a big refilling of the pool of public goods, as it were, because it's nearly $2 trillion in 1 year to help American families who are struggling, to help us put an end to this pandemic. The bill will cut child poverty in half, which reminds us that poverty is a choice and that public policy decisions can make poverty a thing of the past. In fact, for just a little bit more than the cost of the 2017 Republican tax cuts that went largely to the wealthy and corporations, the United States government could eliminate poverty in the United States overall. And so these are choices that we are making as a society. It's a choice when we keep the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour, where people can work full time and still be in poverty. That's a policy choice. And so I'm proud to say that our current president wants to nearly double it to $15 an hour to make it a real living wage. And these kinds of policies that invest in our people again, that invest in building America at a time when our roads and bridges get a D+ from the American Society of Civil Engineers, are really learning from the past. They're learning from other countries in the world that have looked at America's example from the 20th century and sped ahead of us on issues like broadband and high-speed rail and the kind of human infrastructure like childcare and paid family leave. It's time for the United States to play catch-up and not do it in a way that discriminates, but invest in all of our people equally and, in fact, equitably, recognizing that one size doesn't fit all, and some neighborhoods that have long been disinvested from need even extra investment. And that's the approach that the Biden-Harris administration is taking now.
And what about this solidarity dividend to which you refer? We've been talking about the causes of inequality, and let's look at now some solutions. You talk about the solidarity dividend. What examples did you find in your travels that give you some hope?
Well, thank you so much for raising that. In my travels, I came across something that I began to call the solidarity dividend, and that's the idea of these gains that can be unlocked only when we join arms across lines of race. If you think about it, the most important things in life, we simply can't do on our own. I can't clean up the air in my neighborhood or make my children's school a better funded school or build a reliable electric grid or high-speed rail or universal broadband or, you know, have a health system to handle pandemics. That's what we have to do together. And this racial division, this us versus them mentality has been to our detriment in the U.S. in not being able to unlock those solidarity dividends. And yet I started to see signs of this changing, of in communities from a multiracial organization of working class folks in Richmond, California, taking on a big polluter in their neighborhood, to across the country in Maine, where a dying mill town found new life when white local folks reached out across so many barriers to welcome African Muslim refugees who revitalized their main street and their economy and their school system. We are so much stronger when we join forces together. And it's not easy. The United States is a place where there is someone here with a tie to every community on the globe. We are ancestral strangers from one another, and we are trying to create a sense of being one people. And it's certainly not easy when we have politicians and news media that seeks to divide us and pit working people against working people. And yet I do believe that we are, particularly starting with the youngest generation, seeing a shift away from that us versus them thinking, seeing folks roll up their sleeves and want to get to work together to build a better country and, dare I say, a better world for all of us.
Yes, I do think we have a lot of hope in the youth who are much more open-minded, perhaps, than their parents. So let me turn now to Chris. I'm sure you have one more question.
Yeah, Heather, what message do you want readers to come away with from your book? Is it a greater understanding, like you said, of how if we work collectively and band together, we can make this country better for all people?
Yeah, that is a good enough summation as any. I want readers of all races to be more curious and empathetic about the ways in which we are connected, the ways in which our fates are linked, and a way in the ways in which the most important things in life are things that we can help each other to provide for all of us. But we have to unite and have empathy and recognize that, you know, despite all of our cultural, linguistic, national origin, ethnic, religious differences, we pretty much all want the same things. You know, we want meaningful work, a roof over our heads, our families to be protected and cared for. And that's something that we can collectively provide for all of us.
And Heather, I don't want to end on a down note, but let's be clear that we are seeing the rise of white supremacist groups now, perhaps a consequence of the years of the Trump administration where Mr. Trump himself seemed to stoke the racial divide and stoke white supremacy. Are you concerned about the ability to overcome this phenomenon that we're seeing? And of course, we have to mention even in the criminal justice system and the incidents of police brutality we're witnessing, of course, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the murder trial. He has been charged with second and third degree murder of George Floyd, whose death resonated around the world.
Yes, we have manifold challenges, you know, but I think about the way in which the Chauvin trial had on the stand testimony of bystanders, young girls, a white woman firefighter, a black man who was trained in martial arts and wrestling and held back from freeing, which I think he probably physically could have done, right? Freeing a man whose life was being snuffed out in front of him, a firefighter who was trained to go into danger and save lives and was held back by police while they killed George Floyd, young girls who should never have had to see that, who shakily held the phone to create the video that was seen around the world. In many ways, those bystanders who wanted to help, who are haunted by that moment, they are America too, and much more representative of our people than the man with the knee on the neck. And I think there's always been this battle for the soul of this country. And yet the largest social movement in American history this summer, 90% of the demonstrations for Black Lives Matter were in majority white counties. We are seeing a country that wants to do better and do right. And I think that is the direction that we are going in.
The book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone, and How We Can Prosper Together. The author, Heather McGee. Heather, thanks so much for sharing your insights about your book, and congratulations. It couldn't come at a more timely moment.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was VOA national correspondent Chris Simpkins. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.